It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It seems like it should be simple. When someone believes something isn't true, you just give them the facts. Show them the evidence and they'll change their tune. But facts are surprisingly easy to disregard when they threaten a person's closely held beliefs. Today, we'll talk about the psychology behind why people cling to their beliefs, even in the face of overwhelming evidence. And to start us off, producers Lindsay Moon and Anna Williams asked people in Iowa City to give us an example of either a time someone tried to convince them to change their mind or they tried to convince someone else.
My wife continually tried to get me to go to Trumpet Blossom Cafe in Iowa City, and I would not go because it was a vegetarian cafe, and for some reason I thought, oh, it can't possibly be any good because they don't have meat products there. Well, I finally ended up going there, and they have amazing mixed drinks, so all is forgiven.
I do mostly online stuff rather than in person, and actually, sometimes you can convince people, but some people, I think, have too much pride that you can be right, but they don't want to, like, fess up to it or anything.
I tried to convince the bouncers at the bar that I was 21 and my ID that I had was real. It was a blonde girl. I'm black. So it worked, though. It worked. But it took a lot of convincing. It took me like 5 minutes. So,
well, I am really into band. In high school, and my brother, who's younger than me, plays saxophone. And I wanted him to continue band in high school, and he did not want to. And I tried to convince him by saying he'd make friends and get used to like high school that way. But I don't know. I couldn't convince him.
I don't try to convince people of things because I think it's futile.
Well, my dad is from like from the coast, and then my mom is from the deep south, so they just have very different views about just about everything. They'll try to convince each other, but they get pretty heated about it. Yeah, they just disagree on things.
Yeah, I don't really want to bring up any issue that's political, maybe how do we do things in India? Maybe we have regards for things, so I have to convince people about how to dress up, and if there's some American friend coming to my place and they have their etiquettes, they would put their feet on the table. In India, that's culturally very offending. So suggesting that idea to an American friend was something that comes to my mind where I had to convince them, no, this is not goes with us. So, yeah.
The voices of people in Iowa City talking about times they have either been convinced to change their minds or tried to convince somebody else to change their minds. And of course, there are many things culturally right now that make it seem like people are more willing to ignore facts or evidence than they used to be. But this is not a new phenomenon. In fact, it's something that humans are very susceptible to. So we've asked a couple of psychologists to help us understand what's going on this hour. Doug Gentile is here. He is professor of psychology at Iowa State University. Hello, Doug.
So why do you believe I'm Doug?
That's a great question.
What evidence would convince you I'm not?
Well, you sound like Doug. All right. Zlatan Krijan is also here. He is an associate professor of psychology at Iowa State University. Hello, Zlatan.
Hello. Good to be back.
Well, thank you both so much for being here today. And let's start with the very basic question. When somebody believes something, when they've made up their mind about something, why is it so hard to change their mind, even if you have evidence and facts, let's say, on your side? Doug, do you want to start us off?
Sure. I think that we misunderstand humans just from, you know, right from the time of Descartes, who said, I think, therefore I am. And we believe that thinking is primary and that therefore information, cognitive information, would be really valuable and convincing. But in fact, humans are emotional creatures. We are far more convinced by our feelings. So it's really, Descartes should have said, I feel, therefore I am. Because, and teenagers, the only ones who tell you the truth. They do some crazy thing. You say, why did you do that? And
because
they say,
I felt like it.
If they even know that, they usually just go, I don't know. And that's the truth. They didn't think it through. And so you know this to be true. If you're trying to decide, do I do this or do I do that? All you have to do is flip a coin and you'll know whether it's right or not, right? That, you know, if it tells you to do the one you really don't want to do, you ignore it. And if it tells you the one you do want to do, you feel justified then. So information isn't really the best way to get to convince people of anything. If I want to convince you of something, I have to give you some motivational reason why you should believe it, why you should want to do it. And motivation shares the same Latin root as emotion. It comes from the Latin meaning to move. So humans are moved by emotional things, not by rational things most of the time.
Zlatan, you want to add something to that?
Yes, I mean, I think I would definitely agree with that. E. Cummings wrote a poem once called Since Feeling is First, in which he basically, for example, one verse goes, since feeling is first, who pays any attention to the syntax of things will never wholly kiss you. Although the romantic connection may be relevant here, you know, pointing to feelings as really the basis of human experience is very important here, and it kind of throws a wrench in the way we are trying as a society really to interact with one another, and that is on this cognitive level that's governed by logical structures and you know, hopefully by arguments, but as Doug has just mentioned, that is very difficult. Certain beliefs are more harder to change than others, right? And I think Doug's points already kind of intuits what those beliefs may be, namely those that tend to be emotional. And practically, there are kind of three groups of beliefs. You have beliefs that are long held, so things you always believed and probably were never refuted. So those beliefs can be really difficult to refute because, you know, you've had so many confirmations and no confirmations. A lot of basic things, you know, Earth is round and England is a real country. And, you know, these things nobody's really questioned, let's say. So they will be hard to change. Then where it gets more interesting is beliefs that are central to one's sense of self or identity, right? So these are especially political, ideological beliefs, religious beliefs. Beliefs about sort of values, what's generally good, let's say one ought to help other people or people need to be self-reliant. Very often these beliefs really go to the core of how you think about yourself or how you think a moral person behaves, and these immediately become emotional and thus often resistant to change. And notice that these often very important beliefs, like ideological and religious beliefs, are general and abstract, right? So that automatically makes them harder to refute because you can contextualize them in many different ways, and it's hard to refute every single way in one which can contextualize the general belief, which is why most truisms are there are two and they're opposite from one another and they're both true, such as opposites attract and a distance makes the heart grow fonder. So if you think about these lay statements, they probably both have a kernel of truth, and it'd be very difficult to persuade somebody that either one is not true for some of the reasons I just outlined.
All right. Now, humans as a species tend to be really susceptible to superstition. We like to be able to explain why something happens. So, you know, when something is unexplainable, we still reach for reasons. Is that sort of sense of superstition or the desire to explain things away, is that part of this as well, Zlatan?
Yeah, and I mean, that I think the superstitions really get at our need for understanding and finding patterns in things, right? So a lot of time we'll notice that we are successful if we, I don't know, touched our third button from the top on our shirt. You have these kind of superstitions that can develop because we are very sensitive to any pattern that may be important. And we often may notice patterns that are not really there. And social scientists have a lot of fancy words for these kinds of things, such as illusory correlations, strange things happen on a full moon, which there's no doubt that some strange things happen during the full moon. They just don't. They seem to be more likely to be noticed, if anything, because of this kind of a pattern.
Right. Strange things happen during a crescent moon as well.
Right. And then when you're looking out for certain patterns, and maybe this will be discussion for a little later, right, you're much more likely to find evidence consistent with what you're looking for. So that's another way in which existing beliefs may perpetuate that's related to this point of what you're looking for.
Doug, it sounded like you wanted to jump in there.
Well, I think Zlatan's exactly right about all of that. One of the things, you know, that has been true throughout all of human evolution, but is amazingly more true now, is that the amount of information out there to be detected is way more than we can. And so, you know, the human brain has done a lot of things to try to help reduce it, make it manageable. Part of that is, you know, it's very good at pattern recognition, and it sees patterns even when they're not there. I'm sure you look up at the clouds and you say, oh, that looks like a face, that looks like, you know, a dog. And no, it's just clouds. But the brain is very good at trying to take what is really a complex shape and simplifies it. And it does that with all types of information. And so one of the things that, Z was just mentioning there is that one way we reduce the amount of information overload is to pay more attention to things that already fit with what we know. It's called the confirmation bias. And we ignore information that doesn't make the same amount of sense, that goes against what we already believe or sits outside of that. And so we don't pay the same amount of attention. We don't give it the same weight. You could hear three things that disagree with your belief, and the one that does agree with it is the one you're going to pay far more attention to and feel like that one's, the truth.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We are talking about the psychological reasons behind why it's so difficult to get people to change their minds. People cling to their beliefs, even sometimes in the face of overwhelming evidence to the contrary. We will talk more about it, and we'd love to hear from you. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me this hour, Doug Gentile and Zlatan Krijan. They are psychologists from Iowa State University. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about how difficult it is to convince someone to change their mind about something they believe. Sometimes people cling to a belief even if the facts pile up on the other side in the face of overwhelming evidence. In fact, it happens quite frequently. Doug Gentile is a professor of psychology at Iowa State University. Zlatan Krijan is an associate professor of psychology at Iowa State University. And before the break, we were talking about how people have this tendency to do this. There are lots of things about human nature, about our psychology, that makes it likely that we are going to cling to our beliefs. And you were just talking, Doug, about how you have a confirmation bias. So you may hear four pieces of evidence and three of them contradict what you believe. One of them reinforces it, and you're going to remember the one that reinforces what you believe. So is there a benefit? Why do we do this? What's the payoff for humans that we tend to think this way, Doug?
Sure. Well, let's even back the question up one farther. Why should we believe anything? I mean, if we think about the world, it's constantly changing. You're changing. You're not going to be the same person you are tomorrow, you are today. The people around you aren't going to be the same tomorrow that they are today. Everything's in constant flux. And so why is it we ever believe anything? And the reason is because that's pretty overwhelming. If you actually, treated every day as if everything's totally new, then we probably wouldn't, be able to be very effective at anything. And so, again, going back to this idea that our brains find patterns, things that don't seem to change a lot, we then just take as if there's some, that some truth. And
so that allows us to be successful on a day-to-day basis.
Exactly.
Because if we were constantly questioning everything, we wouldn't get anything done. If we think, I can't trust this water that I'm drinking, I need to go and confirm whether it's actually clean water,
Exactly. And so the brain has built up, the last number I saw is something like 132 of these cognitive biases, you know, that they're ways they, you know, strip down the all of the information we're coming, we're getting into, you know, kind of easier to digest packets. And so there are many of them, you know, we trust people who seem more similar to us, and we will believe their information and be more persuaded by them than people that we see as different from us in some way. And in a sense, that's often useful, right? The people who are similar to us, if you think about evolutionarily, you know, that's where we're getting our culture from many times, or historically we would have, and we can learn the lessons from them. And so that has, you know, historically throughout human history has been useful. But it then comes at a cost, which is then we don't pay attention to many things we should.
And you talk about how we may share beliefs with people who are close to us. Of course, that has changed a lot, who the people are who are close to us, because we used to live in small communities and share these ideas with our neighbors. And that kind of group cohesion made us more likely to survive. But in this day and age, life is incredibly different. I mean, when we think about social media, for example, I mean, we're sort of creating this online community that doesn't have anything to do with our neighbors or the people that we actually see on a day-to-day basis. So, Zlatan, how do you think that has changed or maybe created more conflicts because of our held, you know, deeply held beliefs?
Certainly, I think many people have commented on how the technological advancement has enabled basically these parallel universes of information, sources of information, largely split by ideological basis. So because not just how we evaluate information, which we already mentioned today, often the stuff we like, we kind of ask ourselves, can I believe this? It looks like I can. And things we don't like, we ask ourselves, must I believe this? And usually we don't have to. So there's that piece, but there's also this piece of what, for example, in political psychology, they call selective exposure, right? That you can basically selectively expose yourself, maybe intentionally or unintentionally, for example, just by choices of the media outlets that you watch, such as that you're constantly getting a certain version of events, even if that version is not necessarily always false, or even on average more false than another version, because it's always maybe false in a certain way, and that way usually would be aligned with, let's say, the audience's ideological preferences or cultural background or what have you. It further solidifies existing beliefs, right? And further makes it seem that any kind of other kind of narrative or any other kind of set of facts is less likely to be true. When everything you hear, which of course is not everything what others hear, is a certain way, right? So that can be extremely compelling for people individually and make it very difficult for them to understand how somebody else would have a equally compelling experience based on something obviously very different that they watch.
Well, in the this group cohesion that we used to have in our communities, was there actually maybe more variation from person to person, home to home, because we didn't get to curate the people that we encountered? Doug?
Well, I think that's certainly likely. I think we also probably used to tolerate a wider range of things. Certainly, I was, I grew up saying, you don't talk about, money, politics, or religion because you know people differ and that you can accept them even though they differ, and let's not highlight all those differences. Whereas nowadays, it seems like, there is a tendency to want to start with those things before you decide if you can be friends with them.
I want to get to the phones. We are talking today about the psychology behind why people cling to their beliefs, even in the face of overwhelming evidence sometimes. And I know that a lot of you have experience with this. I'd love to hear about an experience maybe you've had where one of your beliefs was challenged and you changed your mind. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can also email us, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We're going to get to the phones, but Doug, you wanted to say something?
Well, I was just trying to save you there, Charity.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate it. But I had a cough button. All right, let's get to the phones. Jeff is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a comment. All the things you're talking about, it's been something that I've noticed more and more, is that the self-segregation people do to reinforce their beliefs is almost changing how facts are now reported. It used to be, it seems, that there were one or two or three network channels you got, and you had one news program, and there was one set of facts everyone lived by. But now with cable news and the ability to select your views, the way that the news is delivered, so sort of I assume to increase viewership, is, for example, on CNN, if they're talking about something like climate change, they'll give really kind of a basic summary of facts, and then they'll go to a panel, and there'll be one person on one side and one person on the other, and then it ends sort of unconvincingly by saying, you know, well, a lot of debate on both sides. Let's go to commercial, and when we come back, we'll talk about something else, rather than, you know, Walter Cronkite saying, this is the world and this is the way it is. And I think that's almost because CNN or whoever knows that you can go to another channel if you want to get your opinions, and so they're not going to take a side in the fear of alienating groups. And I think that's sort of a way that's kind of to our detriment as a society, that we can't even now get a coherent group of facts together, and it makes more people want to disagree with each other or think that the disagreement is valid on things that otherwise we might think 20 years ago were not debatable.
Jeff, that is an incredibly interesting point. We could also spend an entire hour talking about false balance and how journalists approach some very difficult issues. I have many things to say about that, but I won't. But Doug, do you want to jump in there? What do you think about what Jeff was talking about?
Well, yeah, I think he's exactly right that the news is a profit-making venture. Especially as we defund public radio and television. And so then they are doing things to try to increase viewership. And there's this, you know, doctrine that you mentioned, Charity, that, you know, journalists are trained to get both sides of every story. And that is a perfectly valid way to approach issues that are about opinion, such as politics. But when we're talking about things that are about science, such as, you know, is the Earth's atmosphere changing? You know, is the planet heating up? That's just a fact. That, you know, and there isn't a debate. And so why would you get both sides of every story? Because it, you know, if 97% of the scientists are, you know, convinced by the data, first of all, you never convince 100%. And there's always some crank who's willing to say exactly the opposite of any position. But why do you bring that person on when the science seems overwhelming? And so this is a place where the news media have really failed the public by not being able to separate out, you know, fact from opinion, which is something we try to teach fourth graders in their English classes, and yet we're still not able to do it very well in the news organizations.
Well, and Zlatan, you mentioned something earlier about these beliefs that have something to do with our sense of identity. And you mentioned, in the same breath, you mentioned religion and political parties. So would you say that religion and political parties, are these the same kind of core beliefs for people, that same kind of identifying part of a person's life?
There are definitely important parallels there. I mean, just to give you a couple, both of these set of beliefs are usually adopted before you understand anything about anything, namely as a child, right? Religious beliefs are usually just kind of picked up for your parents and from your community, and political beliefs just the same, and only later in life, sometimes some people may change those more or less. But so just because of that makes them obviously very core to who people are, or at least were at one point. And those kind of beliefs are, as a result, much more likely to create defensiveness, to create this kind of dynamics we discussed in terms of selective exposure, because nobody wants to believe that they've been wrong about something so important for so long, right? That is just threatening to people.
Yeah, well, my father always said that the world is divided into people who think they're right. and when we're talking about, you know, beliefs, there can be motivation, right? That we want to feel like we're right. We want to feel like we understand the world. We want to feel like we've figured something out and are right. And that can bring into play, you know, all sorts of psychological mechanisms to try to make sure that we continue to believe that we're right.
Well, and you mentioned we were talking about climate science on one hand and politics on the other hand. I mean, earlier, Doug, you were talking about how appealing to somebody's emotions is a more effective way of convincing them of something than using facts. Is that what we're doing by politicizing subjects that really aren't inherently political at all?
Well, I think so. And if you think about the arguments that get made in the public, they tend to not use facts. The easiest example is, say, political advertising, right? When you're trying to choose between two candidates, it would be useful to pay attention to a lot of facts. What was their voting record, or how much experience do they have in this, what evidence can we use to believe what they say? And yet the ads tend to just be, you know, you can't trust this person because they look different, or there's something that's very emotional and almost tribal in the way these political ads, especially the attack ads, get used, that don't really give much information. They instead just try to, they use scary music and scary images and try to get you to feel something negative about the person. So you end up saying, well, I don't like this candidate. Or I don't like either candidate, but, I'm going to go with this one, for some equally kind of weird reason. They seem, more like an average guy I could have a drink with, which is probably not why how we should be picking our politicians. But often
that is exactly how.
And the politicians know that. And so they work very hard to, obfuscate facts and instead play on people's emotions.
If I may add to that, this goes back to some of the, philosophical points Doug has mentioned at the beginning of the program, what is belief, can belief be factual or not, et cetera. And it's important for us to remember that the beliefs are functional. They have a purpose. William James, who's one of the founding fathers of psychology, has been really important in pointing out that we believe something because it has worked for us. And Richard Dawkins, the famous evolutionary biologist, is often fond of making the same point about science in general, how, why should we follow science? He likes to say, because it works. So for an organism, generally believing something is there because it has worked, and that can mean several different things. Psychologists have distinguished, for example, different functions that attitudes can have. We've been kind of focused on whether belief is true, so does it have this correspondence in reality, which is definitely very important, and we need to have a lot of those beliefs if we as a society are going to try to move forward. But beliefs also have, value expressive functions. Sometimes I believe something because that's what people in my group believe. Maybe I didn't think a lot about it. Maybe I wouldn't even believe it if I really scrutinized it, but it's important that I adopt it, or it's just a way you show who you are. Or maybe you just think it's good to believe something, whatever it is. And these are, I think, the complexities that underlie a lot of difficulties I think we're experiencing, especially today in such a fragmented informational world.
Well, and Zlatan, I know we have to say goodbye to you here in just a moment. Doug's going to stay with us. But, obviously this kind of phenomenon dates back to the beginning of human cultures. Do you see it as something that is heightened right now because we maybe understand more about how to emotionally manipulate each other?
Yes, so in some way it's old news, but I think we have gotten better at fooling ourselves and from profiting at it that can make kind of running a society more tricky. But these changes have also been so rapid that it's really hard to anticipate how things are going to look in 20 years. And I certainly won't dare to do so, but maybe Doug is brave enough, and I'll leave it to him.
All right. Well, Zlatan Krishan, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, great.
Thank you both.
Yeah, Zlatan Krishan is an associate professor of psychology at Iowa State University. Doug Gentile stays in the hot seat. He's going to be with us when we come back from a break. Doug Gentile is professor of psychology at Iowa State. We have a number of people on the phones right now. We'll get to those calls just as soon as we get back. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the psychology behind why people cling to their beliefs, even sometimes in the face of overwhelming evidence to the contrary. Why facts are not always persuasive. You are welcome to join our conversation, 866-780-9100. I would love to hear about your experiences if you've had your mind changed about something, or maybe you've helped someone else change their mind. 866-780-9100. You can email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Doug Gentile is here. He's professor of psychology at Iowa State University. And let's get to the phones. Carol is on the line in Eastern Iowa. Hi, Carol.
Hi, Charity. Thank you for taking my call. What I wanted to talk about was how my own belief system was really impacted much later, probably in my 50s, having been raised in a very religious and actually kind family, and one that really had a great importance or stress placed upon being charitable and not being selfish. But, you know, week in and week out, all the literature, the Christian literature that I was reading, really set my expectations and beliefs in a certain way. And yet I had been a fan of public radio for over 20 years and listened to many, many, many discussions. And what happened was that I started balancing listening to public radio and to Christian radio just about 50-50%. And what happened is that I took all of the information that I heard, and I observed what was happening in our country, in our communities, to disadvantaged peoples, and it no longer jived. I could no longer accept my childhood beliefs, my early adult beliefs, as being something that I could cling to, because there's so much inequity. And so that really helped me change what I believe in.
That's so interesting, Carol. And do you think that there was something that happened in your life that made you more open to questioning those ideals?
I think observations of even local people who espoused such great, you know, beliefs in their, and I don't want to be disparaging, in their faith that they were raised in. And yet, I saw so much greed and hoarding and inequity in the way that they cared for their employees, in the way that they lavished themselves with things, to the great absence of any even marginally comfortable means for their employees.
Interesting. Well, Carol,
thank you so much for
sharing your story. And, I mean, Doug, that's an experience that I know many people have had, but it's also relatively unusual, isn't it?
I think so. That often, you know, it's not that, you know, people don't change their beliefs. They certainly do. But they usually need some reason to change it. You can, for example, you know, imagine the person who's, you know, always, you know, had very negative beliefs about, say, you know, gay people. And then it turns out one of their children is gay, and they have to now look at it a different way. And they may still end up with the same belief, or they may not. But it often takes, as you were asking, you know, is there a particular reason? Did something happen that made you all of a sudden pay attention in a different way or be more open to change? It sounds like in Carol's case, it was just a, the water faucet just drip, 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 dripping, and she kept seeing this inconsistency between espoused beliefs and people's actions. And we can put up with that, for a while before we start to really question. And, and that can change your belief.
Well, Carol, again, thank you so much for your call. I want to go to Kajal on the line right now. Hello.
Hi. I'm so happy to be here again. I actually am very impressed with what Carol said, and I had something to add to that. So what do you think is the place of cognitive dissonance in countering this, holding on to beliefs? And I'm wondering if that is a process, which is a pretty powerful process, which can be introduced, throughout our education system, where you're exposed to different viewpoints about the same thing instead of having been taught that this is how it is. For instance, today morning, my six-year-old daughter told me, Mom, the writing system starts from the left and finishes on the right. And I said, that is true for English and many other languages, but not for several others in the world, like not Arabic or Japanese. And there was shock on her face that, there are different ways of doing something. So I'm just wondering how that would make people more reflective about different viewpoints and more viable to, question what they believe.
Yeah, interesting. Thank you so much for bringing that up. And Doug, there's evidence of that, that there are ways to sort of prime people to question things.
Sure. Well, I think, there's a meaty topic. So, cognitive dissonance is when you are getting information in that doesn't fit what you already believe, and we feel some discomfort. And what do you do with that discomfort? Most of the time, what we do is we find a way to relieve that discomfort. Now, we can do that by discounting the evidence we've heard or discounting the believability of the source of that evidence. Or we can say, it's just a fluke. Or we can say, wow, maybe my belief was wrong. But that's the less typical way of going about it. So, almost all of our beliefs start with something that seems true to us and often is true, at least to us. If you and I played a game of cards, Charity, at the end of that game of cards, could we tell the same story about what happened? No. Because you were sitting on one side of the table, you looked this way, right? I'm sitting on the other side. I looked that way. You knew your cards, planned a strategy based on them. I knew mine. I planned a strategy based on mine. I had to change mine in a certain way as I saw your cards come out. You changed yours in a different way. So there's no possible way we could actually tell the same story about what happened in that game of cards. Well, who's right?
Both of us.
Yeah, exactly. And even though our stories don't match, we can both be right because the world is that complex and our point of view is so limited. And that's part of what I think causes these apparent conflicts when, in fact, many times, ultimately, we really agree with each other. We're just paying attention from our side of the table.
Well, there's also a phenomenon that occurs when people may even have sort of an intellectual understanding that what is being said to them or what is being presented is not true, but then they choose to believe it or invest in it because they feel like it gets to an ultimate truth.
Mm-hmm.
That's something else that we're able to hold two completely opposing ideas in our brains at the same time and come to a different conclusion.
Yeah. Well, there's a good book out there that helps explain this if people want to read it. It's called Why Everyone Else is a Hypocrite. and it's written by an evolutionary psychologist who the basic idea is that different parts of our brains evolved in response to different things they needed to do. And so there is a part of our brain that pays attention to how are we being perceived by others. There's a part of our brain that pays attention to what are my physical needs right now. There's a part of our brain that, so there are all these different modules in our brain. And they all are picking up different information, but they also can lead to different conclusions, which is why we actually often hold two very contradictory views at once, but in different contexts. And they're both equally true because the one is relevant to this, you know, function of our life, whereas the other is relevant to a different function. And even if we see that, we're not really bothered by it because they both still feel true.
Well, and I want to get back to something that Kajal was saying about introducing the idea of other ideas to kids, but also to adults. So what are some of the things that make people more likely to be open to facts and evidence, I guess?
Well, I think that there isn't a, you know, a one-size-fits-all answer to this. But certainly helping people to recognize that other people do have different viewpoints and they're equally, you know, they share the same amount of truth as your side of the table in the card game shares with mine. Whereas often we don't do that. We instead think that because I'm right, the other is wrong. And so getting beyond that dichotomous thinking, recognizing that there may not be one truth out there, that there might be different ways of viewing it, that if I had grown up the way you grew up, I would probably believe something very different. And starting to be able to do that perspective taking around, you know, what is someone else's experience like? What are the things that, you know, they grew up with, the types of experiences they had, what they the pressures they were under, and how that might actually mean they've come to very different conclusions. And if I was in their shoes, I'd probably come to those same conclusions. And so it helps to loosen up our own hold on just how right we are by being able to do that.
So cultivating a sense of empathy.
Empathy is critical for this, and the perspective-taking part of empathy, I think, is perhaps the most important, that we can understand that other viewpoints we may not agree with, but they can be equally valid.
I want to get to Peter on the line in West Des Moines. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Charity. This is a little bit of a controversial subject, and I don't want to name any names. I have been involved in a long-time fight, along with many people in my culture, in regards to a certain government in Turkey that denied their actions during World War I, actions of genocide, and that government is currently promoting to its own people, as well as people in other countries, including the U.S., that their government during that time didn't do what it did, committed acts of genocide against my people and others.
So, Peter, I think you're talking about the Armenian genocide, which there's actually a popular film about coming out very soon, so I'm sure that's a subject that people will learn a great deal more about. But I want to get to Peter's question here, which isn't necessarily about that event, but about all of these different events in histories. I mean, we have people who deny that the Holocaust happened during World War II. We have people who deny that the moon landing happened. How is it that large groups of people can embrace an idea that seems to be contradictory to all evidence of history?
Yeah, well, I think it comes back to this idea, again, of motivated cognition. Why would some people want to deny these things? And when you ask that question, it starts becoming understandable. You know, people become very threatened by certain ideas, particularly if they relate back to your self-identity or your group identity, as, you know, Dr. Krishan had been mentioning, that when something feels like it's part of who we are, then any information that is negative about the, you know, those parts of yourself feels like a personal attack, and that will help to motivate you to find evidence, you know, that buffers you against it. And so, you know, rather than feeling guilty about these horrible things that, you know, happened in these wars, it's much easier if you were on, you know, the side that perpetrated these crimes to say, oh, no, 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 that never happened.
Or even to believe that humans aren't capable of that kind of action.
Yeah. And so it's, you know, it's like the strategy your four-year-old uses to try to convince you that, you know, she didn't steal a cookie. Just no, you know, that never happened. And in fact, you know, there was once a time when I went to a political camp to learn how to be a candidate, and they go through training in how do you handle crises, like if you're caught doing something wrong. And the number one thing is just deny. The number two thing is you apologize and say you'll never do it again. But it's always, in either of these cases, it's trying to get away from ambiguity. It's trying to just make it a very clear statement, only this is true, because that reduces questioning. And I think that's one of the things here, is that people don't really like to feel, live in this place of uncertainty. That's uncomfortable for most people. They'd much rather think that they understand something about truth, even though truth is constantly shifting and often related to someone's point of view.
Steve is on the line in Ames. Hi, Steve.
Good morning.
What's your comment? Quickly, we're running out of time. Yeah,
I know that. One of the basic premises that I try and live by when listening to other people's opinions is a line from Woody Allen from a movie where he said, "Objectivity is subjective." And I always try and remember that your viewpoint is limited by what you know, and unless you know everything, you can't be right necessarily. And I always try and keep that in mind whenever I'm discussing any subject, mostly politics, with other people, that even though I think I'm right, I'm limited by what I know.
Steve,
it really helps me.
Thank you so much for bringing that up. And, you know, Doug, we've heard from people this hour talking about ways that they can be more open to other people's ideas. Although I think that the large frustration that a lot of people feel is when other people are not open to their ideas. So change begins at home. But what can we take away from what we know about beliefs when we're trying to convince someone else or share facts, evidence with someone else to try to change their opinion? What can we use from psychology to be more persuasive?
Well, often start with, you know, where the shared ground is. Then often what's useful is kind of your personal story, which is the emotional side, not just the facts. And people tend to be much more swayed by a personal anecdote than by scientific fact, unfortunately.
Well, Doug Gentile, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Doug Gentile is a professor of psychology at Iowa State University. This hour, we've been talking about why people cling to their beliefs, even in the face of overwhelming evidence at times. Talk of Iowa is produced by Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Lindsay Moon, Dennis Reese, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.